beauty converge. Paper money is truly one of the revolutionary inventions of human history.
The 100th object in a history of the world is revealed in the Today programme on BBC Radio 4 on Thursday morning at 7:45.
We're back here on Radio 3. A very good afternoon to you. Welcome along if you've recently tuned in. I'm Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the programmes this afternoon, which continue in a moment with a look at the music and the life of Thomas Arne, arguably one of England's most misunderstood musicians. The Early Music Show is next on Radio 3, after a summary of the news from Vaughan Savage.
Two Iraqis on trial for the murder of six British soldiers have been acquitted of murder after the court said there was not enough evidence to prosecute them. The Royal Military policemen were ambushed and killed in Majar al-Kabir in southern Iraq in 2003. One of the defendants has been ordered to be detained for further investigation. The other man has been released. A cabinet minister has said that variable-rate student loans might be used to raise funds for universities in England. The Transport Secretary, Philip Hammond, was speaking after the Business Secretary, Vince Cable, ruled out the graduate tax he suggested in July. Mr. Cable said such a measure would be unfair. The man widely tipped to be North Korea's next leader has been seen on live state television in the country. Kim Jong-un attended a military parade alongside his father Kim Jong-il in the capital Pyongyang. Pakistani officials say an American missile attack has killed at least six people in North Waziristan, close to the Afghan border. The missiles were fired from unmanned drones and targeted a compound in a refugee camp. A murder investigation is underway after a woman died following an assault in her home in Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire yesterday. Police arrested a 16-year-old boy and a 21-year-old man. There have been violent clashes in the Serbian capital, Belgrade, during a gay pride march. The march has been interrupted by far-right groups who say it's contrary to Serbian values. The soul singer Solomon Burke has died, aged 70, in Amsterdam. Solomon Burke, who was most famous for writing the song Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, had been due to perform in the city this week. He had been a performer for more than 50 years and was a Grammy Award winner, as well as the father of 21 children. The weather, it should be a sunny afternoon in most places, but remaining overcast in northeastern parts with occasional drizzle. Tonight, cloud will spread from the north and east into much of the Midlands and Wales. It'll be a cooler and breezier night than of late. The BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
And it was read by Vaughan Savage. Well, Beethoven, Fauré and Finzi are among the composers featured in this week's batch of Radio 3 requests in an hour from now. But with the time at 1:03, it's time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping, which begins with a rather familiar tune.
Good factor, or a bit too jingoistic for comfort. Whichever side you're on, a rousing song to open the show today with Rule Britannia. Some people think it should be our national anthem, or I'm not sure how our football team would cope with all those semi-quavers. Oh, and by the way, it is actually Britannia Rule the Waves, the command, not Rules the Waves, as we tend to hear it these days. The song's probably best known as the traditional ending to The Last Night at the Proms, conjuring up images of John Bull in his red, white and blue, or Britannia with her shield and trident, and it became universally popular during the Jacobite Rising of 1745. But what many people don't realise is that Rule Britannia wasn't just a one-off song composed to inspire the nation. It was actually written to be part of a play, the closing number of a drama, or masque, written in 1740 for Frederick, Prince of Wales, the eldest son of George II. The mask was called Alfred, and with its heady mix of British patriotism and royal heroism, I guess it was the perfect entertainment for a prince. Dr. Thomas Arne was the composer, and it may be surprising to hear that despite being a Londoner through and through, he was never invited to write music for coronations, grand state occasions or religious ceremonies. That sort of thing was nicely covered, thank you very much, by our favourite adopted German George Frederick Handel. No, Dr. Arne, 25 years Handel's junior, never had an official appointment of any kind. In fact, he remained forever in Handel's shadow, a bit of an outsider who earned a precarious living in the playhouses and pleasure gardens of his native city. So why was the man who penned Rule Britannia overlooked by those who did indeed rule the waves? Well, for a start, it didn't help that he was a committed Roman Catholic. Added to that, he was by all accounts a prickly character, a terminal philanderer, had a fiery temper, was an erratic teacher, and to cap it all, he had no head for business. Hardly the sort of fellow then that the titled folk who tend to dish out the honours were going to invite over to share a glass of sherry. And even Thomas Arne's musical colleagues found him hard going. "I fear his heart is too hardened to harbour any social virtue," wrote one of them. "I have tried, but he has proved unworthy of any man's friendship." Oh dear, just as I was beginning to like him. And yet, does it really matter? This crotchety genius may not have been anyone's bestest friend, but he could certainly knock off a heart-rending ballad, which made him one of the best English songsmiths of his generation, just as Purcell had been 100 years earlier. And if you're not convinced, have a listen to this, another aria from The Mask of Alfred that clearly demonstrates Arne's ability to write the most tender of melodies. This is the soprano Jennifer Smith as Edith, lamenting the death of her lover in battle, a youth adorned with every art. Morn he left me, he fought and fell. The aria, A Youth Adorned with Every Art, from Thomas Arne's Masque Alfred, first performed in the Prince of Wales' country residence, Cliveden House, in the summer of 1740. The soprano Jennifer Smith in the role of Edith, with Nicholas McGeegan conducting the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. So who exactly was this not altogether likeable Thomas Arne? Well, for one so closely associated with musical theatre, he was born in the right place anyway, Covent Garden, in 1710, the year, incidentally, that Handel arrived in London. His family were in the upholstery business, and apart from a slight hiccup in their fortunes when his grandfather was banged up in a debtor's prison, his father did pretty well, renting a substantial house in Covent Garden and sending Thomas to Eton. The plan was for him to go into law, but the schoolboy had other ideas. He was set on becoming a musician. And according to Burney, who knew him in adulthood, Arne smuggled a spinet into his room and, muffling the strings with a handkerchief, practised secretly through the night while the rest of the family slept. He also borrowed a servant's livery to gain admission in disguise to the gallery of the Italian Opera. And it was here, by chance, that he got to know a member of the theatre orchestra, Michael Festing, who was also a composer, and the two of them regularly went to concerts together. Nevertheless, when Arne left school, as per plan, he was sent to be articled at a solicitor's office. His father hoped his son would now put his musical interests aside, so he was shocked and not a little angry to catch him one evening leading a group of chamber musicians at a friend's house. Luckily, Michael Festing came to the rescue, persuaded Arne Senior that his son had got what it took to earn a good living in the music business, and Thomas, now with his father's blessing, threw himself into the music world with energy. He taught his younger siblings to sing, and together they gave a performance of Handel's Acis and Galatea at the Haymarket Theatre, organised, financed and publicised, by the way, by their father. It was a great success, and the trio continued to perform in a number of productions, including Thomas's very first opera, Rosamund, in 1733. Arne was now 23 years old and in love. The object of his amours was an actress and singer called Cecilia Young, and despite her father's objections to having a Catholic son-in-law, they were married, and Cecilia appeared in many of Arne's subsequent opera productions, including Alfred. David Daniels and the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan, in an aria from Thomas Arne's Masque, Alfred. Why beats my heart with such devotion? Arne was indeed devoted to his new wife, Cecilia. At least he was at first, but more of that later. Within 3 years, a son appeared, Michael. And although there's some debate today as to exactly who his father was, he may even have been adopted, the young boy evidently flourished in this musical household. So by 1745, things were going pretty swimmingly for the Arnes. London audiences loved the sort of music Thomas was producing and lapped it up in a string of hit shows, popular operas and masques produced at Drury Lane Theatre. All of them starred either his wife or his sister, Susanna, who by now was one of the most celebrated actresses in London and known by her married name, Mrs. Cibber. What's more, that same year, Arne unveiled his other huge hit, God Save Our Noble King, which was quickly adopted as the new national anthem. That year also saw the launch of London's famous pleasure gardens in Vauxhall. It's a sorry place these days, a litter-strewn patch of grass in the shadow of the Victorian railway bridge. But 260 years ago, it was the place to see and be seen. A magical Arcadian setting where you could walk, eat and canoodle under the fairy lights to the sound of Arne's delightful songs, which for more than two decades were regularly heard wafting out from the garden's pretty bandstand. And yet, in spite of being one of London's most popular songwriters, Arne's was perhaps a rather narrow musical career. He may have been the only Englishman who could offer Handel any serious competition in the theatre, but because of his Catholic faith, he was denied any official posts at court or in the church. So, as a way of broadening his appeal, Arne now got to work on a number of instrumental and orchestral pieces, including a set of 8 overtures. They were hardly groundbreaking. In fact, they sound almost quaintly baroque rather than looking forward to the on-trend classical style of, say, J.C. Bach or Mozart. But that sort of familiarity only gave them added appeal with the public. Here's the penultimate one of the set, number 7 in D.
Thank you.
Simon Standish directing Collegium Musicum 90 in an overture by Thomas Arne. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping. I mentioned earlier how Arne, like so many composers, supplemented his earnings by doing a bit of teaching. One of his pupils was Charles Burney, the eminent musicologist who trained with Arne for nearly 3 years, although Burney, in common it seems with so many others, wasn't particularly fond of his mentor, whom he later described as selfish and immoral. It seems Arne's extramarital affairs were somewhat legendary. But when it came to the keyboard, he was in a class of his own. A wonderful sketch now in the V&A shows him in action at the Ivories, looking very snooty indeed. But then he was probably playing one of his own sonatas. Ewald Demeyer with a harpsichord sonata in E minor by Thomas Arne, who's the focus of today's early music show. So Arne wasn't the most popular of fellows, and it seems his quarrelsome nature ran in the family. In 1750, his sister Susanna, the famous actress and singer, had a blazing row with David Garrick at Drury Lane. She stormed out and flounced into the rival theatre at Covent Garden, taking her talents and presumably her loyal fans with her. Whether it was an argument about money or perhaps a casting issue, we don't know, but pretty soon Thomas followed her and became the musical director there for the next quarter of a century. Arne's own immediate family life wasn't much better either. He was hopeless with money, and rumours of various infidelities put his marriage under intense strain. Finally, his wife could take it no more. He accused her of being mentally ill, and they separated. Almost immediately, Arne began a relationship with his star singer and pupil, Charlotte Brent, who was 25 years his junior. Needless to say, this was quite a good career move for her, as she appeared in most of his next string of operas, including one of the biggest stage successes, Thomas and Sally. I say operas because this work was indeed the very first English comic opera to be sung all through, rather than just being a play with incidental music. Premiered in November 1760 in front of King George II, Thomas and Sally enjoyed a lengthy run in London. And because it was one of Arne's few stage works not to have been destroyed in the disastrous fire at Covent Garden in 1808, it's been revived a few times in recent years. There's no complete recording of it as yet, though record companies take note, but I can at least play you the very jolly overture.
Thank you.
Scottish snaps, so popular with 18th century London audiences who romanticised anything folksily north of the border, characterising the second half of the overture to Thomas Arne's opera Thomas and Sally. It was first performed in the autumn of 1760 and it was played there by Collegium Musicum 90, directed by Simon Standage. If Thomas and Sally was the first real English comic opera, then Arne's next big success, Artaxerxes, was England's first opera seria, in other words, serious or noble work that harked back to the old classical ideals, kind of reaction to the lightweight dramas that were often seen on the London stage. For this, Arne used a 30-year-old libretto by Metastasio, which he's believed to have translated himself. And from its opening night at Covent Garden, Artaxerxes was very well received, enjoying a very good run. Mind you, it wasn't without its dramas, both on and off stage. During the second run the following year, the theatre management, for some reason, saw fit to abolish half-price tickets. And suddenly, in the middle of a performance, a protest mob stormed the auditorium. A journal of the time, the Gentleman's Magazine, gives us the lowdown. The mischief done was the greatest ever known on any occasion of the like kind. All the benches of the boxes and pit being entirely tore up, the glasses and chandeliers broken, and the linings of the boxes cut to pieces. The rashness of the rioters was so great that they cut away the wooden pillars between the boxes, so if the inside of them had not been iron, they would have brought down the galleries upon their heads. Makes today's audience seem rather boring, doesn't it? But then you can understand their desperation to get into the show, because Artaxerxes featured two of the greatest box office stars of the day, the Italian castrati, Niccolò Peretti and Giusto Tenducci. Demasculated they may have been, but to many they were major pin-ups. Along with these exotic creatures was another reason the crowds queued around the block. Arne's lover, Charlotte Brent, was singing the role of Artaxerxes' sister, Mandane, and who could resist her in a thrilling aria like this?
Thank you.
Catherine Bott and the Parley of Instruments with the energetic and with all those virtuosic runs, very Italianesque aria, Fly, Soft Ideas, Fly. It's from Artaxerxes, one of the very few of Arne's 100 or so stage works that are still heard today. By the mid-1760s, Artaxerxes had confirmed Arne's reputation as the talk of the town. Audiences flocked to his shows, even fought for tickets, as we've heard. But he was nevertheless continually niggled by the notion that he wasn't taken seriously enough outside the theatre. The solution? To get his music performed in what was seen as the more highbrow end of the London music scene, Carlisle House in London's Soho. This was a venue run by two energetic young musicians with impeccable pedigrees, Bach's youngest son, J.C., and his friend Carl Friedrich Abel. As London's first ever subscription concerts. Here, audiences could hear pieces by the cream of Europe's composers. If Arne wanted to be part of all this, he'd need to produce something suitable. And the result was a set of four symphonies. We're going to hear one of them now in a recording by the ensemble Cantilena, conducted by Adrian Shepherd. Symphony number 2 in F major. Thomas Arne's Symphony No. 2 in F, performed there by Cantilena, conducted by Adrian Shepherd. Arne's tempestuous relationship with his starlet, Charlotte Brent, finally ended in the 1770s, and she married the violinist George Pinto. Arne, never one to be on his own for long, was reunited with his wife, Cecilia, shortly before he died a few years later. Perhaps it was mainly his Catholicism that held him back in the end from the sort of acclaim that he deserved. But then maybe it really was a hard time for any homegrown composer to shine in the city where Handel had made his home, and of course where audiences had such a liking for continental music. It was unfortunate, too, that so many of Arne's opera scores were lost in the Covent Garden fire, because what remains shows Arne was indeed an outstanding composer, and yes, with a touch of real genius. Let's end the programme with an aria from one of his last stage works, a masque setting of George Colman's libretto, The Fairy Prince. This caused a sensation when it opened in November 1771, as the role of Titania was played by an 11-year-old debutante, Anne Brown, who was later to become one of the most celebrated and sought-after stars of her day. Perhaps a sort of Charlotte Church figure, but a lot naughtier. Actually, some of you may remember Anne from a previous early music show that I did. She was a singer whose life was cut short in a dramatic shipwreck off the rocks of the Scilly Isles. That's another story, of course, for another time. But we can recall her watery demise, and for one final time today, the great Dr. Arne himself in this aria, Melt Earth to Sea.
The aria Melt Earth to Sea from Thomas Arne's Masque the Fairy Prince, performed there by the soprano Rachel Nichols with Pavel Sivchak at the harpsichord. And that ends today's early music show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt. On next Saturday's programme, Catherine Bott will be interviewing the organist and music director Ton Copeman. So do join us for that at the usual time, just after the 1 o'clock news on Saturday lunchtime here on BBC Radio 3.
On BBC Radio 3, the Finnish soprano Soile Isakoski returns to London's Wigmore Hall. A live Radio 3 lunchtime concert featuring songs by her countryman Toivo Kula, alongside Du Parc and Robert Schumann. The great Finnish soprano, Soile Isakoski, in a live BBC Radio 3 lunchtime concert. Tomorrow at 1.
Well, back to today, and in a couple of hours' time, we'll be in Lincoln to hear again Wednesday's service from Lincoln Cathedral on the Feast of the Translation of St. Hugh of Lincoln. That's Choral Evensong at 4 o'clock. And then Stephen Johnson discovers more music, exploring Shostakovich's two very different piano trios in Discovery Music at 5. But next this afternoon on Radio 3, here's Fiona Talkington with 2 hours of your Radio 3 requests.
Thanks very much. Lots of your piano-inspired requests this afternoon, beginning with this favourite by Beethoven.
Thank you.
the wonderfully named Rage Over a Lost Penny by Beethoven, elegantly played there by Anatole Ugorsky, and requested this afternoon by someone who just signs himself Roger. As I mentioned, there's plenty of piano music in Radio 3 requests today, and my guest requester is the pianist Gunilla Sussman. But next, a different kind of keyboard. Deborah Thorne was at an organ recital in Durham Cathedral recently, and the final item in the programme made quite an impression on her. Like you, Deborah, I'd never heard of the composer Gaston Litaize either, but I discovered that he was in his 80s when he died in 1991, having spent much of his life teaching at the French National Institute for the Blind, having been a student there himself, as he was also blind. This is Litaize's powerful prelude and dance fugue, played at the organ of Bordeaux Cathedral by Colin Andrews.